Welcome to Story of a Storyteller. I'm your host, Connor Braden. This is the show where I found out all about the ins and outs of the lives of storytellers of all kinds. You can find my free novella, The Stolen Dagger, episode show notes, links to all sorts of amazing books, and more at connorbraden.com/podcast. Enjoy! Hello one and all, and welcome to the second episode of the second season of Story of a Storyteller. Today's episode, I got to interview Dougie Brimson, author of fiction and non-fiction books, as well as a screenwriter. Dougie and I talk at first about how he got his first book deal in 1996 called Everywhere We Go, and how he managed then to be brought over to Hollywood to write the film Green Street, which starred Elijah Wood and Charlie Hunnam. Although proud of the film, Dougie does go on to explain that he wasn't as happy with how his experience went. What I loved about this interview is how much we ended up drifting away from the questions I had prepared and ended up discussing things like Dougie's thoughts on classism within the publishing industry. In my own writing updates, I've been very busy with the earliest stages of planning my adult thrillers sequel. While I try to at the same time figure out what I'm going to do with my children's fantasy first draft. To be honest, one of the things I find most difficult about writing is how alone we writers really are in the earlier parts of our creative process. In my day job as a teacher, I can go to other teachers and ask for advice or opinions when I need guidance. That can be from teachers who are more experienced than me, or even teachers that aren't, but that they're more skilled in certain areas than I am. But with writing, it's a lot harder. The kind of help we sometimes need means people have to be intimately in the know with what our manuscripts are, or who as writers we are or want to be, so it can be very difficult to get advice. Either way, it's something every writer has to figure out, so I'm just on my own for now. Before we listen to Dougie's interview, I would like to mention a huge thanks to the amazing response that last week's episode with David Ledain has received, and a special thanks to David himself for once again giving such a great interview. But that's all from me for now. Let's check out Dougie's interview. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Story of a Storyteller. And my guest today is Dougie Brimson. Dougie, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Great. Dougie, you have like 16 books and you've sold over
a million. I'm not sure if it's 16 or 17. I've never been particularly sure.
Okay, so, well, not 16 and not 18.
16 and a half. I've got one halfway through.
Good, 16 and a half. As well as, for those listening and watching, as well as being a screenplay writer, film writer, and one of his films you might know, the movie Green Street with Elijah Wood and Charlie Hunnam. And we're going to get into all that bit by bit. But Dougie, I think my first question is, you're a man that has multiple books. You have movies made of the scripts you've written. You have non-fiction books as well as fiction. You have thrillers, you have comedies. Like, it looks like from the outside, you're somebody who always wanted to get into writing. Would you say that's the case?
No, not far from the case. I never set out to be a writer at all. I never wanted to be a writer. I still struggle to come to terms with calling myself an author or a professional writer. I literally fell into it by accident. I left school at 16, went into the Air Force, did 18 years in the Air Force. And then when I came out in 1994, I had absolutely no idea of what I wanted to do, other than the fact I didn't really want to be an engineer and I didn't really want to work for anybody else. And I ended up working as an extra on film and TV, doing stuff like The Bill, movies and TV stuff. I did a Bond movie. I did all sorts of stuff. You'll see me walking around in the background. And
what Bond movie was it?
I think it was From Russia with Love.
Oh, okay.
You can see me driving around in the background. So it was great. It was, I mean, it was brilliant fun. And then Euro 96 was approaching, which was the European Championships, football championships to be held in England. And there was a lot of talk about football hooliganism and the potential threat it posed. And as someone who'd been going to football all my life, really, me and my younger brother, who I used to work with all the time, we started to think all this stuff that they're saying is bollocks, really. it doesn't equate to us as two lads. I mean, we weren't particularly hooligans. We were just lads who went to football and got and liked the culture, the clothes and the music and all that stuff that was prevalent at the time. And the violence is kind of was a spectator sport for us.
Mm.
But if you went home and away, it was with your club, as we did, you know, it was everywhere. And all this stuff we were hearing didn't equate to us. And we started to think, we should look at a way to try and make some money out of this. And the obvious one was a book.
Yeah.
And so we started speaking to other lads that we were working with on film sets. And their experiences.
Oh, so your brother was doing extra work as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's how I got into it. I had two brothers doing extra work at the time.
Oh, okay. Family business then.
We used to work together a lot. And we were talking to other lads on film sets, and their experiences was the same as ours. Their opinions were the same as ours. So we started to work out how we could do it. I mean, this was still mid-95.
Okay.
And we came up with a format which we thought would work. We knew we couldn't write about ourselves because we were just peripheral figures. We didn't, you know, we didn't want a writer. We went there and beat them up and then came home type book. We wanted to write something that kind of contradicted all this stuff that was being said, that we was all right wing and from broken homes and thick and all that sort of nonsense. And so we worked out that the best way to do it was to use other people's stories and give them an opportunity to tell their stories. Because when you go to football, all you do is tell stories about this, that, you know, it's a thing. So we started asking lads if they'd want to write something for us. We wrote some of our stuff. And then in amongst that, we did a history. We researched the history of hooliganism more from a bloke's perspective than an academia world. And we interspersed that with our opinions on all the issues relating to football, like the policing, the media, racism, politics, hooliganism, all that sort of stuff. And we thought there's a book now. We've got the outline for a book. So we started to put flesh on the bones. And then in the end, we realised if this is going to work, we've got to get it published because it's got to be out in May 96, ahead of the term.
It was
just a waste of time.
There was an opportunity coming up, and
had a window of opportunity. We had no idea if anybody else was ever going to do it, but we thought, well, we might as well have a shot. And so I walked into Smith's, picked up a book, I think it was Gary Lineker's autobiography. It was published by Hodder Headline. I wrote to Hodder Headline, said, we want to do this. Are you interested? It landed on the desk of a guy called Ian Marshall, who was the guy who does the Playfair cricket annuals every year. He still doesn't. Yeah. And he wrote back to me straight away and said, we're interested. Can you send us some stuff?
Mm.
So I sent him some stuff. He liked it. Said, can you send me some more? We sent him some more. He said, can you send me some more? And I said, well, you've got about 10,000 words now. You either want it or you don't. If you don't, then we need to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I was actually sitting in a bar in Hamburg.
That was if you don't mind me saying, that was a gutsy move to, as a.
The thing was, this was the thing, you know, we didn't know any other authors.
Yeah.
We didn't know how it worked at all. It was purely a punt on our part. And it was a long time before I realized this isn't how it works for everybody.
Mm.
You know, and I was in Hamburg, drinking a bar with an actor called Tony Hogarth, who, you know, is long dead now, but he was famous, very famous at the time. And my wife rang me and said, there's a letter here from Headline. And I said, well, I'll open it. And she said, they want to do your book and they want to pay you in advance.
Oh, great.
And it was brilliant. And it was, we were off and running. You know, as simple as that. And the book came out in May 95. Mm-hmm. And we, because we both had shaven heads, we were both like yorbish looking blokes. And Headline said to us, look, how do you want to promote this? And we said, you just get us anywhere and everywhere. We'll do whatever you want us to do because we just want to sell shitloads of books. Because we thought we'll write one book and we'll make enough money to retire. And to their credit, Headline got us in on everywhere, primarily because the media, the country was in a frenzy about this tournament anyway. Mm. And all of us, and they've been talking about hooliganism. It was the big issue. It was the big fear. And all of a sudden you've got two shaven-headed yobs who are like pro-hooligan. Effectively, that's what we were portrayed as.
Yeah.
And they thought, we've got, you know, this is like raw meat for us to chew on and gob out. And we'd go in, we didn't take no shit. We were quite eloquent, quite considered. We didn't argue with anybody. We just put our points across. And we were everywhere, from breakfast TV to late night TV, Radio 5, talk radio, everywhere. And the book went mental, absolutely mental. In fact, we released it in 2011 when eBooks kicked in.
Yeah.
And it's on the free book, I gave it away for free. And it's at number two on the football chart today, still at number two.
Wow.
Well, another one of my books is at number one, so.
Oh, well then.
Struck a note with everybody. Everybody loved it. Well, not everybody. I still get some grief about it now.
Yeah.
I got some today, as you saw.
Yeah.
he's one of my favourite Charles. And, we just kicked on and we did some more. We did, you know, I did, I think we did seven in 5 years.
Yeah, looking at your...
books. We did three more using the same format. Because one of the things we'd done is we worked out, who we were writing it for, which is vital, absolutely vital.
Right.
And we were writing it for us and blokes like us. And we're not traditional readers, you know. Mm. And we worked out where blokes read on toilets, trains, or in bed. So we constructed the book in short chunks. And all of my books are still like that now. Because you can read a chunk and then go to sleep or finish, get off the toilet. Mm. Or you can sit on the toilet and read another chunk and another chunk. Or you can read it all. And it's a format that really seems to work. Blokes like it, you know, even women who read it seem to like it, but it works for me.
Mm.
And I've carried on writing like that ever since. And I've just carried on churning stuff out. If people keep buying them, I'll keep writing them.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's a really important point because you, unbeknownst to yourself, like you kind of struck gold almost because you were looking for how can I put it? By deciding to write for yourself, you kind of accidentally discovered a whole new genre almost in this.
Yeah, but we knew they were there. We knew these people were there, you know, and it's, but no one was giving them anything.
Yeah,
you get the odd book, and this continues today. This is one of my big problems with publishing today.
Mm.
You know, you've got 50% of the population are male. Within that are a lot of working class blokes who aren't your traditional readers. They don't want to go in the local indie bookstore and trawl around and see what someone's going to recommend to them. They're going to hear about a book. I want to read that book. That's what I want to take on holiday. That's what I want to read to them when I'm going to work or when I'm going to sleep. They want to hear about it, which is one of the beauties of the internet, of course.
Yeah.
And but it's got to be relatable to them. They've got to be able to see themselves in it and recognise themselves. The characters have got to be relatable.
Yeah.
They don't like, and I'm not being condescending or patronising in any way because I'm talking about myself.
Yeah.
I don't like flowery stuff. I don't like he walked out of his front door and there was a mist settling in the dips in the meadow and all his bollocks. I want to say he went out his front door and got in his car, bang, on to the next thing. And you leave the reader to paint those pictures in your head. One of the interesting things with my characters, because I let the reader put an image of that character in their head. And I know, like in The Crew and Top Dog and In the Know, I know what Billy Evans looks like. And it's one of the problems I had when we went to film, when we filmed Top Dog, was a big transition, because the Billy Evans in my head suddenly became Leo Gregory. And it was a massive transition for me. It was a massive shift. But I let the reader develop those characters. I'll give them a bit, you know, but that's their job. You've got to leave them. One of the interesting things with doing scripts is, and it's some advice a lot of people have given me over the years, leave the actor something to do. You've got to leave the actor time and space to act. Well, it's the same in my books. I leave the reader, he's got to do some work. I'll tell him the story. The rest of it is up to him. And that's what, in my experience, and I can only talk about my experience, that's what blokes like to do. No one else is really doing it for them. And I find it bizarre that the publishing world seems to ignore this huge market that's out. I mean, I've shifted a million books. You don't do that by
You're one man. Do you know, like, I'm saying you shifted a million books and you're only one man. Like, it just shows how much there seems to be.
And I've never had any mainstream marketing other than the first four books. It's just word of mouth. So why is no one else looking at this market? You know, I just find it absolutely, but especially at the moment, when publishers are, you know, going through so many problems, and there's this huge market out there which no one is other than me and a few other guys, no one's really servicing. You can look at Piglet, and it's
why do you think that this market is? I don't know. Do you mind? Like, first, actually, here I have two questions for you. One, why do you think this market is not catered for? And my second question is, do you think that's because it's ignored, or do you think it's just people don't realize it is a market?
I think my problem, and it's something I it gets me into trouble, but I'm quite happy with that. I think one of the big problems for publishing is that the commissioning and editorial side of things at most publishers, in my experience, again, are female.
Okay.
And they don't get blokes. They just don't get this market. They don't understand how they can reach it, how they can relate to it. You know, it's absolutely pointless me pitching a football lad's book at a 30-year-old university graduate from the suburbs.
Yeah.
Because she's not really interested. And that's not just my experience. I've had that same thing with other, you know, the independent male authors. I just don't think they don't get it. And at a time where they don't want to take any risks. It's easier to do the same thing because they're all frightened of losing their jobs or making a big mistake. And I understand that. But there's, because of that, I mean, thank God for indie publishing. It's just this huge, everything that's going on at the moment in particular, is it's focused on a particular market. For me, it's focused on this kind of middle class female readership. You've got this endless stream of chick lit, you know, and Twitter is awash. You know, such and such a publisher has signed the debut female author. Excited about debut female author. I've probably seen 20 today, 20 different ones today. Not seen a single male one. And that's a big problem for publishing. I keep saying this, but it's true. I've sold a million books. I haven't got a publishing deal.
Yeah.
At all. I do it all myself. I have to do it all myself because no publisher will take me on. And I never had an agent up until the beginning of this year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's, not for want of trying, but in the end you just give up, you know, and it's like, I don't need this, you know, and I'm not, you know, this sounds like me moaning, but I'm not moaning. I'm out here doing it. I'm earning a decent living. You know, I'm just churning out, you know, I've got a book halfway through. I've got another book to write after that. But you just think, not that I could be doing better because I'm not doing bad, But there's always this thing of, what could I have done if, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This leads on to another thing, and I'm sorry, because I'm kind of in the groove now.
Yeah, do you know what? It's fine. I've only asked one question, and you're flying. That's fine, yeah. It's great.
one of the offshoots, one of the consequences of the lockdown stuff.
Yeah.
Was at the beginning, we had indie bookshops are in trouble. You know, all the bookshops are going to close. We need to save the bookshops. Blah, blah, blah. So what they called for was all the authors point your readers in the direction of your local bookshop.
Mm.
Not to Amazon, not to the monster that is. Yeah. And I'm watching this thinking, I've got a book on the way out, right? I've literally, when did all this start? January, February, sort of. I had a book out in May, In and Out came out May 14th. So I sat down and wrote to 52 independent bookshops.
Okay.
Through email, through Twitter, everything. I said, right, I'm happy to send, I've got a book coming out, sent them the blurb for the book. I'm happy to send you readers to you, but can you confirm you're going to stock it?
Yeah.
Who of those 52 replied? Just two.
Wow.
You know, and they both said, we're not going to stock it, but we can order it. Well, screw you.
Mm.
You're not the only ones in trouble. My publisher, who's an indie publisher, is also in trouble. So I'll send them straight to, rather than go through you, I'll send them straight to him.
Mm.
And which means I also earn more money and they get their books faster.
Yeah.
Or I'll send them to Amazon. I've got no problem with Amazon at all.
Yeah.
Because they're my main outlet.
Yeah.
But what the point is, there was this big thing, we're all in this together. We've got to save publishing together. But the indie bookshops weren't doing anything. They weren't doing anything to help anybody else.
Mm.
They weren't doing anything for indie authors, for sure. And this all that, this big all for one, one for all, it was crap. It was just a self-serving push. I've written something for this for the Crime Writers Association.
Oh, okay.
This week, so I'm expecting loads of flack from that. But that's my experience.
Yeah.
That's my experience of it. No one, in the know's done great. The crew has been, it's the number one today. It's been there for 20 years.
Yeah.
9 years unbroken, pretty much unbroken as an ebook on the on its number one chart, the football chart on Amazon.
Yeah, there you go.
The market's there. But if you're not going to help me reach that market, why should I help you?
Would you think, just, I don't think this, I'm just picking up on the phrases.
Go for it.
No, it's all right, do you think that there's a bit of classism in that? Like, do you think?
Oh my God, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the publishing world is rank with snobbery, literally snobbery. Mm. I've been invited to two literary events in my entire career. I've been a pro writer since 1992.
Only two.
Okay. One of them I had to get myself invited to.
Right.
The other one was a headline thing.
Which was your publisher, so that.
Pardon?
And that headline was your publisher, wasn't it?
Headline was my publisher at the time. And the authors had got together because they were complaining about the lack of publicity. Because as is still now, all of the publicity efforts were going into Barbara Windsor's autobiography and celeb autobiographies, which were really starting to take off.
Mm.
And I went into this room, listened to all these middle-class snobs. I'm sat at the back feeling completely out of place.
Yeah.
And there was a woman stood with me. She must have been in the 60s or 70s then. And am I allowed to swear on your pod? Okay, I won't swear then.
No, you can't, it's fine. I'll just make sure to tell people at the start, that's all.
she said, she looked at me and she said, look at these effing snobs. She said, I feel like I should be here serving a tray of drinks. And I said to her, I'm exactly the same. And we got talking.
Hmm.
And it turned out that it was Gilda O'Neill, who was like multi-million selling, authoress at the time. She's dead now, unfortunately. But she said to me, this industry is, if you're working class, you've got no chance of getting accepted because they'll never accept you. Mm-hmm. And it's true. It's true to this day. I mean, there's a movement on Twitter at the moment, working class writers.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And there was a report out earlier this year that we need to get more working class people into writing, into publishing generally. Of course, But that report has died. The movement has pretty much died because they don't have to do it. And they won't do it. And yet you've got, you know, I write for a working class, predominantly working class male readership. No one gives a shit.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to. Yeah, they're quite, they're just ignoring this potential market. You know, the most important person in publishing is the reader.
Because of course. Without
a reader, you haven't got anything. Yet far too many publishers seem to forget that. They think they're in this little bubble, which is all literary events and, you know, launch parties and crap like that. But at the end of the day, if someone doesn't buy that book and sit down to read it, and it's exactly the same with a movie,
yeah,
you know, it's going to tank and somebody's going to lose money. And at some point, someone's going to have to start thinking about what aren't we looking at?
Okay, well, what
aren't we looking at?
I, in defense of publishers, and not saying you're wrong, but I would say what I, for my, now I've never even spoken to a publisher. I self-published my book without even trying to get it published. But my understanding of publishing now is that they understand their audience, like in the sense of, apart from your huge, big worldwide publishers like Penguin and all those, that most publishers are, well, we are an Irish children's book publisher. We are a British cookbook publisher. We are so has the argument been put to you and to this concept of working class writers being ignored of starting up a publishing house for specifically marketing to working class readers and to looking for working class authors?
Do you think I wish I'd done it. I mean, I had the opportunity to do it about 10 years ago and I wish I'd done it.
Yeah.
But at that time, I was more into doing film stuff, so I didn't bother.
Okay.
I think there's certainly room, I think, for an imprint within one of the big houses. And I've been told there's a couple starting to look specifically. But again, and this will probably get me into trouble, the ones I've heard of are all headed by women.
Okay.
So effectively, you're just moving from my perspective as an author. It's just a different layer of the same problem. Mm. It's a very strange one. I don't get it. I can't imagine another commercial enterprise which would so clearly ignore a huge market, and yet it seems to be. I don't know. When you know. I wrote about this recently. When you say, you know, Nick Hornby is the father of Ladlit.
Yeah.
He wrote Fever Pitch. Great. But I don't know a working class lad who would read High Fidelity. I wouldn't read it. Or Letter to Juliet. I wouldn't bloody read that. I've got no interest in it.
Yeah.
You know? Yet he's the one they think, oh, he's Mr. Ladlit. That's crap. Absolute crap.
You brought that up, and I actually did want to bring up this idea. So there's so many different things I want to ask you, and I don't know where to start. Let's start with Ladlit. What, first, for anyone listening or watching, that what is that? Could you define what you think Ladlit is? And maybe as well, Hoolilit, because I know you've spoken about
that. Ladlit, you know, I don't like these genre titles. I mean, someone says you're a niche author. Well, I'm a bloke. I write for males. Is a male a niche? You know, is that a niche readership? It's a ridiculous thing to say.
Yeah.
Ladlit is, you know, for me, is working class lads. That's who I write for. That's who, you know, or I still consider myself to be. Hoolilit was different because that was a target. That was a label that was thrown at us. Mm. Because all of a sudden, when we bought out our first few books, Eddie and I, and we did four together, and then we went our separate ways writing-wise, there were a lot of people said, well, we can, because there were certain books that we weren't interested in writing.
Okay.
I wasn't interested in doing a book about specific clubs,
okay,
you know, the Manchester United, Leeds, Middlesbrough. I wasn't interested in that because it means I would have to go there. And I've got no interest, you know, I go watch Watford. I don't want to go watch Middlesbrough or Leeds unless Watford at Middlesbrough or Leeds. I don't have interest in that. And I'd never know enough that the guy's there. So a lot of guys jumped on that bandwagon. I use that term in the nicest possible sense, because something had started. Publishers at that time were springing up who were looking for that kind of thing, because they realized suddenly there's money there. And within about 5 or 6 years, and it's something that has never, it's something else that I have an issue with. This has never really been acknowledged by publishing at all. We were selling a lot of books, and you had guys like Cass Pennant came along who also, you know, wrote some great books. All of a sudden in sports pages in London, you've got a whole section which is devoted to football hooligan books, hooli books, which is what we were all tagged as, hooli lit. In the end, there were something like 72 books written which were in within that genre, and they're still coming out as most, they're all indie published now. But most of those books were by first-time authors.
Okay.
Now, that's a huge deal, because you've suddenly, all of a sudden, you've got all these working-class blokes who are writing, and some of them went on to write some really, really good stuff. And they also brought a lot of people back into reading who had never, who hadn't read anything, because they had no interest in it. They, all of a sudden, you've got someone like them who's writing about them, about a world that they know intimately. So they're back reading. You know, and I still get letters from guys just say, yours are the only books I've ever read.
Right.
You know, I haven't read a book for years. I picked up The Crew. I picked up Everywhere We Go. It's effing brilliant. What have you done any more? And it's, well, yeah, I've got another 15 or 16. Whatever. That never got, what, that was a phenomenal thing. It also made a lot of people a lot of money. And, but it never got acknowledged. I don't think it's happened before or since.
Yeah.
And it goes back to this thing about market. That market was bang, 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 bang. And it was allowed by publishing to just drift out. To be fair, the quality of the work coming out wasn't great at the end, but people were still buying it.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I mean, you could have something that's badly written, but it could sell millions of copies, and then something that someone,
what you've got to say to that,
crafting, and then it doesn't sell. So like, which one is the better book? You know,
all you've got to do is say 50 Shades of Grey to show exactly where it can go horribly wrong. Yeah, look at what happened.
Yeah,
and in it, it's, and look what it spawned, and you know, everything purely because they got behind it. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah
I'm not going to write 50 Shades of Lad. I've got no interest in that.
No, well, I suppose this is the thing. You write to what your audience wants. And if your audience wanted that, maybe it would, but I don't think they do.
Yeah, not me. I mean, I'm driven by my readers, really. Not just in the sense of, you know, they keep me going, but I read... the Amazon reviews, I read emails they send me, I read tweets and stuff like that, all about my stuff, because they're gold, you know, because they tell me what they like.
Yeah.
And they tell me what they don't like. I mean, in the Crew, when someone wrote to me, wrote an Amazon review, whereas it was 5-star review, love the book. Oh no, it's 4-star review, love the book, did a great long thing about the book. But my one comment, they're smoking all the time. And it's the, and what, and he was right. What he said was, the author, it's almost like the author uses it as a plot device to buy himself time. And I realized he's absolutely right.
Okay.
And so in Top Dog, which was a sequel, they hardly smoke at all.
They have that nicotine patch.
No, he does it every so often. No, it's just, but it was just like he lit a cigarette. Because that, for me, that filled up the page pile, but it buys me character time and stuff like that. And all that information is in there. You just got to dig it out and find it. But yeah. I wouldn't, as you said before, I've written a huge, diverse range of stuff.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't write anything. I've got a nice collection of beta readers who have all come from my readership. And... I'll always ask them about a project before I start it. And if they say no...
Before you start writing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
If they say no, say, why the F and L would I want to read crap like that? And I won't do it.
Hey, that's interesting. I've never heard of someone using beta readers to, like, pre-approve something before you've even put pen to
paper. Oh yeah, because what would be the point in me writing it if no one's going to buy it?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, I've got a project. I'm working on a book now, which is my first military thriller.
Oh, okay.
Which is going really well. And I've done, again, through Facebook, my beta readers, I've just run a competition for people to name the characters in a book. Have a character in the book named after them.
Very good.
And that finished yesterday. So I've named all my characters after. I've just done cut and replace today with all these new names.
Yeah.
And but the one after that is going to be a big departure for me because it's based on a script. It's about four women. And I'll probably write that under a pseudonym because I would really, really like to get that into a bookshop because it's much more marketable kind of book, I think.
Okay. And then why is it? So I find this interesting because you seem to be, I don't want to say against publishing houses and stuff, but it's more like you've made it very clear that you feel unrepresented and ignored by the publishing houses. So now you have this other project, which I'm sure you don't want to talk too much about the premise and stuff about. So why are you now going to them instead of staying indie?
Purely because I think it's not my readership. It's not aimed at my readership. This it's about four women, so it's a comedy, and I've done comedies before.
Yeah.
But it's not a bloke's comedy. It's more of it's in the same kind of vein as the Thursday Murder Club, if you like. Oh. And I couldn't reach that market because I've got no links with it at all. And I would need to get it to somebody who could do that for me because it's a film as well. Hopefully it'll be a film. So it'll be a film tie-in, which gives it an extra dimension, of course. So I'm almost certainly going to do that. And I'm not particularly convinced that my readers would go for this book, which is another thing. But it's one of those books, you know, I've always wanted to write. Ever since I heard about this story, I've just thought this is a great book.
Yeah.
And it's a stretch for myself, really.
That's good. It's good. It's good to push and challenge oneself as well. Like even when, you know your niche. Well, as you said, it's not even a niche, really. I mean, it's too broad, but you know your audience and you have written different things for them. You've written comedies, you've written thrillers, you've written fiction, nonfiction, and even films. And that's one thing I wanted to pick your brain about as well, about writing for film. And I get that you started writing for film probably because you experienced being on a film set. You were in ads and TV shows. And
no, it's not how it started at all.
No, I know that's not how it started, but I mean, I'm sure that's how you decided to not to go for it, but...
No, I'll tell you exactly why I went for it.
Yeah, go on. Well, that's basically what I was getting you to say, so go on.
I can make shitloads of money here. That's exactly why I thought about it. Because I don't do this for fun. It's my job.
Yeah.
And people say, what motivates you to write? Blah, blah, blah. Money motivates.
Money.
Nothing else. I don't care about anything else. You know, I don't do this for fun.
Yeah,
I don't sit at a computer for 8 hours a day or whatever it is, or get up at 5 o'clock as I do every morning.
Yeah.
Get a computer for 3 or 4 hours and write for fun. You know, I'm not driven to do it. I never wanted to be a writer. I still don't particularly want to be a writer, but it just so happens. And this is a big, important point. You know, you can teach anybody to be a writer. You can't teach anybody to tell a story. You can either tell a story or you can't. Now, that's something I got from my dad. My dad was a storyteller. He was a professional storyteller. Oh. So I can tell a story. And that's how I earn my living.
Mm.
You know? And so I'll only work on a project if it's going to sell because it will make me money.
Yeah. You know?
And that's what I do. Now, when the film thing came along, to be fair, though, the first one, which was a short movie.
Yeah.
I did. That was just a football hooligan thing. So I thought, that's a really interesting idea. It'll be a lot of fun. See if I can do it. So I did it. And then Green Street came in. And that was a different kettle of fish entirely. We're talking like Hollywood. So you think
huge.
Huge money.
huge jump as well to go from a short film to Elijah Wood and Charlie Hunnam. You know, could you tell the story? Because I know you kind of, I don't want to say tricked, but you cleverly got around kind of in a backdoor way to get to somebody in terms of.
Well, what happened? I mean, I've told this story lots of times, but it's, you know, what happened was at that time the internet was quite fledgling, if you like.
Yeah.
And there were all kinds of forums, secret forums for football hooligans, and there were some that were public. You know, the police and the media were all over. So we were all writing, we were all using fake names.
Yeah.
And there was also a thing where a lot of guys wouldn't talk to me, you know, because they think, well, A, he's mining for ideas, B, he's grass because he's grassing up our work.
Yeah.
Crap like that. So I use a false name, as everybody did, because we didn't want to get nicked as well, which is the other thing.
Yeah.
Someone said to me, there's this woman, she wants to do a film about football from America. So we all laugh and joke. But me, a light bulb went on above my head almost. So I tracked this email down, dropped her an email using a fake name and fake address. And over a period of a couple of weeks, got to know her quite well, sounded her out. She seemed, you know, on the level.
Yeah.
And then it got to a point where I said, you need to speak to this guy, Dougie Brimson. Have you heard of his books? Blah, 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 blah. I said, no, I've never heard of him. I'll check him out. I said, well, shit. So we carried on chatting for about another 10 days. And I said, have you made contact with him yet? She said, I don't want to talk to him.
Oh.
And I said, why not? She said, oh, I'm quite happy talking to you, you know, because I was given to the point where, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Because I'm kind of concerned about whatever. So you need to talk to this guy. He's a good guy. Blah, blah, blah. So we carried on chatting. And then I said, have you spoke to him yet? She said, yeah, I spoke to him already. Well, I knew she was lying because...
Because you're you.
Yeah, because I'm me. But so I kept badgering her. And in the end, she did make contact with me. And she said, there's this guy I've been talking to. You know, he keeps telling me again, blah, blah, blah. I need to speak to you. So here I am. So we got chatting and we just clicked, you know, and... I didn't tell her, in fact.
That's what I was going to ask, yeah. Did she even know now?
Yeah, she knows now. Oh. What happened was that we were banging ideas backwards and forwards and we were talking on the phone a lot. And she said, look, this is ridiculous. Just come out to Hollywood. I said, well, I'm not paying to come out to bloody Hollywood, stay in a hotel just for your project.
Yeah.
I said, no, I'll pay. I'll fly you out, put you up in a hotel. I've got money, you know, there's money here already. So I flew out to Hollywood for 10 days and we were in a bar. What had happened was we'd gone to a celeb bar. Right. There's a massive queue outside. You know what they're like in Hollywood, you can imagine. And she walked straight.
I nodded as if I've been there loads and I know.
Yeah, you've seen them all.
But, you know. Yeah.
And she walked straight to the front and I'm walking behind the light, this meek thing. And she said, there's a book, you know, there's a booking for me. And this guy said, there's no booking for you. And she went apeshit at this guy. And he said, I'm really sorry, you know, and showed her in. Because she had some status. She'd done a lot of stunt stuff. And she'd worked with Chuck Norris and people like that.
Okay.
But she just bluffed her way in. And of course, I followed in. And we're in this packed place. And I said, look, I've got something to tell you. You know, you really need to know. And I told her, and she went crazy for about 5 minutes. And I'm just stood there laughing at her. And remember, she's a world kickboxing champion, the woman who directed Green Street.
Oh, okay.
So she's either going to kill me or she's going to laugh. And she's German as well, which didn't help. But she was, you know, in the end, she got the joke. And I said, look, I'm here. We're banging this out. And shortly after that, she got nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For a short movie that I went out there again and took my wife this time. And it was while we were out there, she was working on the script and I read the script and I said, you need to leave this alone and just pitch this out. This is good enough now. And she ended up making it. And as we were developing Green Street, she got nominated for an Oscar for this movie.
Okay, well.
It was a short movie.
Yeah.
And
Molly's.
Yeah. And there was money, just appeared. How much do you want, basically?
Yeah.
And it just went from there. But it was I mean, you did ask me about this. You asked me in this list of questions.
Yeah.
You know, the development of the movie, once we got to the development stage over here, it became a problem because there was just egos. Okay. Egos and money, a fatal combination. And we started having issues over the script. She had brought another writer in because the people putting the money in said, we want another an American writer to take a look at this.
Well, that's fair when it's their money.
It's fair until you saw what he did with the script.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
He'd never been to England. He'd never even seen a game of football before.
Okay.
And it was just embarrassing. I've still got a copy of it, and one day maybe I'll pull it out if they piss me off that much. And I said, you can't use any of this crap. This is ludicrous. So it's started to cause a bit of friction. And then there was other things went on. Me and her had a bit of a falling out, quite a big falling out, particularly over one scene. And I'd argue this just doesn't work. It does not work. Because it's not real. Because in movies, I'm big on authenticity. So everything's got to be authentic. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. And we'd set out to write the British Fight Club. That's what we wanted to do from day one.
Yeah.
That was what drove me on. Because I thought we could write a cult movie for America. Because my focus was on America, not particularly over here. I mean, it's Elijah Wood, for Christ's sake. You know, yeah. He's a hobbit. Well, you know, I knew what the reaction was going to be over here.
Yeah.
But if you could do it right in America with Charlie Hunnam as well, you might do something massive. And the tone of it was all changed. And then we got to this scene. I said, this doesn't work because all the dialogue is from one person when it should be three people throwing this banter around. And then on the day that we're going to do that scene, I was on set with my daughter. My daughter was in one of the scenes.
All right.
Two of the actors came to me and said, look, can you work with us on this scene? Because it just doesn't work. And I said, yes. So I went into the one of the caravans and there was three of us sat down. Leo Gregory, Mark Warren, and I can't remember the other guy's name. And we went through the scene and they were quite happy. And I went home.
Yeah.
And then that night I get this phone call, like, from the producer, and apparently when they started shooting and they did the dialogue that we'd worked out, she freaked out.
Okay.
And they lost about an hour's worth of shooting. And she said, don't get him back on set again. He can't talk, you know, he can't talk to the actors. And I haven't spoke to her since.
Oh, okay.
I haven't even spoken since. I didn't even go. I got invited to the premiere purely because it was in my contract and I insisted on it just to piss her off. But we never spoke again. And yeah, there's been all sorts of problems about it, which is a shame because it could and should have been a lot better than it was, I think.
Do you still, like, one thing I respect about you is that even though you had issues with it and you weren't happy with it and you literally just said that it could have been a lot better than it was, you still reference it and you still talk about it in a sense because it's still an achievement. Whereas there's a lot of people that...
Why would you not?
Exactly. No, that's my point. I'm agreeing. I'm saying, like, why wouldn't you? Because I feel there is some people who said, no, I wasn't happy with that, so I'm going to distance myself from it. I'm going to say...
Do that.
You know, but that, yeah.
Do that. It's still, you know, it's not a bad movie, you know, and people all over the world still watch it. Well, why would you not want to reference yourself on that? It's my name on the cover. Why not?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, as one of the sad consequences, because a lot of people think it was based on a book and it wasn't. It was in my contract to write the book.
Oh, okay.
And because of rights issues with her, driven by her, the book never got written.
Ah.
It was a real shame. Because it would have been, it would have been a good book, you know, a lot more depth to all the characters. The other thing that happened, sadly, is we were never allowed. I always wanted to develop the Bova character from from the movie, the Leo Gregory
Which character?
Bova.
Okay.
And we weren't allowed to do it. They wouldn't let us do it. So, which was a real shame, because it was money in the bank for him. You know, even as last year, we were talking to Lionsgate about it, and they said they won't release the rights to the character. So
that must be frustrating to like have something you made, but not be able to do something with it.
That's part of. I never consider myself as a screenwriter. Screenwriting was a hobby for me.
Okay.
I don't wish to sound big headed, but I can do it. I can deliver a first or second draft. But I know that a script, you might as well write a script in pencil.
Yeah.
Because as soon as it gets in the hands of the director, it becomes his script. It's his movie. He can demand whatever changes he wants, and I have to give them to him. I can't argue with him. I mean, when we filmed Top Dog, and Martin Kemp from Spandau Ballet directed it. Now, I'm adapting my own book for the screen, so I know the book inside out.
Yeah.
And I delivered him a draft, and he said, come over to, he lives in Rickmansworth, not far from me, and he said, come over to my house, stroke mansion, by massive gates. Come over and we'll talk about script, go over the script. Well, you know, so I whizzed over. There's this like palatial place. He's married to the woman I had a crush on when I was younger, you know, who's still gorgeous. And we sat down, you know, with Martin Kemp to find out about it. And this was the first time, I think this was the first time I'd met him. What a second.
Okay, all right.
And he spent 3 hours ripping my script to shreds. Every single line, pretty much, was red lit. And I was devastated, absolutely devastated. And then at the end, he said to me, you know, everything I'm saying to you is designed to make your script better.
Thank God he said that. That's good.
Yeah, and I said, well, why didn't you? You could have said that at the beginning. Not at the end. When I'm literally on the floor here. And he said, no, the script is brilliant, but we just need to make it better. And I'm like, for Christ's sake. Now he tell me. So, but in the end, the script for Top Dog was great. You know, Top Dog was a good little movie. It just didn't get the traction I think it deserves.
Yeah, yeah.
Great cast. Did some brilliant work. And Top Dog was a great experience as well. Frustrating at times. But yeah, I enjoyed Top Dog more than I enjoyed Green Street.
Yeah, well, that's good. And I suppose the important thing to take from that is even after Green Street was first, so like even after Green Street, you still went for it again. You still went for the screenplay. So
we've Top Dog. I co-produced it as well, so that made it.
Oh, okay.
That was more fun.
You had a bit but more power.
It's not a very enjoyable experience for me personally. I didn't particularly enjoy it. I don't, you know, as the writer, I always say as a screenwriter, you're not the bottom of the ladder. You're the rungs, you're the rubber bungs underneath.
Yeah.
Once you've delivered your script, you're finished. Your role's finished.
Yeah.
So, and all these people who are critical of Green Street or, you know, all the other stuff, it's like my part finished when I handed the paper over.
Mm.
You need to start arguing with other people. But I'm the one who still gets grief for Green Street, for things in Green Street. But it goes with the job.
You know? Yeah.
The writer's the one who gets all the flack. The director's the one who gets all the plaudits, you know. It's the way it is. It's very strange.
I remember when I was very young and I was first kind of, like I'm talking like before I was even a teenager, and I was understanding the difference between like all the jobs of a movie, like actor, director, producer, writer. And I remember thinking, well, what does a director really do? And I know there's people out there who's kind of been like, hey, I'm a director. We do so much, and directors can. But I mean, they can't. You can't direct a film if you don't have actors. The actors can't read lines without the writer. You know,
Funny you should say that. The first time I went to Hollywood, I was in a cafe with a group of writers, screenwriters.
Okay.
And one of them made this great thing, and he said they were talking about screenwriting, and then he said, "Do you think Arnie came up with 'I'll be back'?" said, no. He said, a writer came up with I'll Be Back.
Yeah.
But who gets the credit for it? Arnie's built an entire career on saying I'll Be Back.
Yeah.
The poor writer's completely forgotten. And it's a brilliant point, because the writer is almost irrelevant. You know, he's doesn't get much lower than a writer. But, you know, that's the way it is. It's an industry you go into it. As long as you go into it with your eyes open.
Yeah.
And you protect important. Yourself legally, you know, and contractually. It can be, I mean, it can be brilliant, but it can be awful. It can be so absolutely soul destroying.
Yeah.
But as I say, if, you know, to anybody who wants to write, the first thing I'll say to them is, if you can't take criticism, don't do it.
Yeah.
Just do not do it, because you're going to get slaughtered. It doesn't matter who you are, you're going to get slaughtered at some point.
Yeah.
And if you can't take that, then don't.
I kind of a in the same line as that, somebody told me that you're not a real, they said it jokingly, but they said you're not a real author until you get your first 1-star review on Amazon. I got mine, so yay, I'm real.
We got ours quite early. We got one from Time Out, our first 1-star review.
Oh, really?
For Everywhere We Go, it just come out. And the tournament was like hove in interview. And we read this review, Time Out, and the review was simple. Everywhere We Go, Doug and Eddie Brimson, yeah, right, F off. F*** off. And I'm like, I'm not having that. So we went down to Time Out.
Oh, great. Good.
And said, I want to speak to the guy who wrote this review, because this ain't on. He obviously ain't read the book. You know, this ain't on. And they wouldn't put us through to him. So we went down to Time Out's office, which was in Charing Cross Road, and walked into reception and said, I want to speak to this bloke. He said, well, he's not here. And I said, well, we'll wait. And we all sat down. And about an hour later, he came down. I said, I want to know why you wrote this review. He said, because this is out of order. And he said, my editor told me that's what I had to write. And I said, are you just telling me that, or is that the truth? And he said, no. He said, I'm telling you, that's it. I said, well, that's fair enough. Okay. And we went and had a beer. And then 3 weeks later, Time Out commissioned us to write a piece about the tournament.
Oh, for God's sake. Right.
It was absolutely surreal.
But
that was our first 1-star review. I mean, now I still get them.
I mean,
I get them from trolls.
Yeah.
Trolls are arguing with...
You also get them, in my opinion, and no offense if you've given it 1-star review, obviously, you also get them from idiots, because I've seen 1-star reviews, and it's like, oh, when the book came in the post, the cover was ripped in half, 1-star. It's like, that is...
The best one I had of them was... 1-star, I didn't order this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? Cheers. You just shagged my ranking. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you.
They're fine. You know, if you buy a book, you know, I mean, the crew and Everywhere We Go are free. So if you want to give it a 1-star review, give it a 1-star review. I don't care. It makes no difference to me. You've got a right to an opinion. I've given 1-star reviews to books. Because if I don't like a book, if I read I've read a thriller by a very well-known author recently.
Okay.
And I say read it, I got a third of the way through, for I was so bored that I put it down. And I gave it a 1-star review, and I said, I just can't carry on with this. It's supposed to be a thriller.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to just call it a thriller, at least be thrilling.
Yeah.
It's so dull. And... I think they're funny. I like them. You know, it's a giggle. But if you can't take it, don't do it. You know, not everyone's going to like what you do.
No. That's really important. I mean, when I brought my book out, as I said earlier, I'm a teacher, and some of my coworkers, I know, read them. And it's very interesting because I got the text saying, oh, look, I'm reading your book or something like that. And I say, oh, well, thanks very much. Let me know what you think. And then nothing. So I know they didn't like it. And that's fine, because, as you said, not every book is for everyone. I mean.
See, because I write my books back to front.
Yeah.
I always write the ending first.
Okay.
Because as a very famous author once said, the last chapter is the one that sells the next book.
Yeah.
And so, and all my thrillers are inspired by ideas I've had for endings. So what I'll do is, once I've got that idea in my head, and that's why they've all got twists at the end.
Yeah.
Once I write the ending first, it remains pretty much fixed. And the rest of the book is about character development and plot development to get me to that point.
Mm.
So I can go anywhere. I can take characters anywhere off on any tangent I want because I know where I've got to bring them back to and when.
Yeah.
And so one thing I aspire to is that my books are never boring.
Mm.
And someone said of In the Know, excuse me, the quote was something like, this is a rocket ship of a read, so strap yourself in because you just won't be able to put it down.
Nice.
And I thought, that's it. That'll do. I'm quite happy with that.
That's
and, I've had lots of, particularly within the know, because it's about a lot about what's going on at the moment, not the COVID rubbish, but Brexit and right-wing politics and all that other sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And so it is very fast. It's very fast moving and relatable. You know, if you can get your reader to relate to what you're writing, you're halfway there.
Yeah, that's so true. You need like, and I think that's one thing that I don't want to say impressed because that sounds very condescending and I don't mean to be condescending, but one thing that intrigues me so much about you is you know your audience so well because you are your audience, you know, like, so you know, well, if I like this, I know that I have this readership behind me that will also like it. And buy it more and
that's
more.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a commercial enterprise. I want to make, you know, Darren, who publishes my books at Catherine Knights, I want him to keep going so he can publish the next book. So if I can do that by writing books that are going to make him money and therefore make me money, yeah, then we're quid in. Because I write for me, it's this old thing, write the book that you want to read. Write what you know. I've never understood why people have said, oh, you shouldn't write what you know. That's lazy. Mm. It's crap. See, I don't want to spend, you know, I wouldn't write a book about, you know, Russian ballet in 1980 because I would have to research Russian ballet in 1980. Well, research is so boring.
Yeah.
So time consuming and it's so boring. I've got no interest in stuff like that. I just want to tell a story to entertain because that's something else a lot of writers seem to forget. They're entertainers. Their job is to entertain people. So keep them entertained.
Mm.
If you keep them entertained and give them the kind of thing they want, you can't go wrong. You just can't. It's impossible, especially if, you know, you can structure a story. You know, if I can do it, and I never wrote anything before Everywhere We Go.
Yeah.
Everywhere We Go is the first real thing I'd ever tried to write.
Okay.
Which a lot of people who've read it will confirm. But again, it comes back to this thing. I know, you know, my lot, my readers, they're not interested in the flowery stuff. They're not necessarily in the composition and all that kind of book. I'm never going to win a Booker Prize. I know that. I'm never going to be nominated for the Costa Book of the Year. Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
You know, I write books to entertain the lads I go to football with.
Exactly.
Yeah, my market.
As I said, that's your market and you know it. And
yeah, absolutely.
What I think is important as well, and it's something I constantly have to remind myself, is it's something, I don't know if you know the author and podcaster, Joanna Penn. Always talks about you should have your own definition of success because for some authors, getting the Booker Prize is their main goal and that's all they want. And if that's what they want, great, go for it. You know, fair play, but you know what you want, and what you want is you want to be able to earn a living from it by selling to an exact audience, and that's what you're doing.
I just you know, for me it's about, if a lad will come up to me at football and say, I read In the Know, that's it, you'll do me
perfect, you know? What more do you want?
At the end of the month, I have a royalty lump come in, that's fine, that's all I need. I don't want to be you know, J.K. Rowling. I just like doing what I do, you know, and long may it continue.
Dougie, there were so many questions that I had prepped and ready, and
we have to do it again.
We didn't do any of them, but that's okay because this has been a brilliant conversation, and I'm realizing we're running out of time now. So I'll have to get you on again in the future to talk more about
anytime.
You know, your career in the Air Force and so much more of the things I'd like to get to know. So we'll leave this as a to be continued, and I'll get you back some other day.
I just want to say one question you asked me. The last book I read, because I've just read The Thursday Murder Club.
Oh, okay.
Richard Osman book, because I bowed to pressure. It's a fantastic book, but the ending left me a bit flat. Have you read it?
No.
The way it's written is just sublime. It's just a brilliant book. And it's one of the books you read and you think, shit, I wish I could have done it. Why can't I write like this? But I'm currently reading a book called Harrier 809 by Roland White, which is it's about the Harriers in the Falklands War, the Sea Harriers in the Falklands War.
Okay.
And it's, I cannot put it, it's not often I say this, but I cannot put this book down. It's absolutely brilliant. And it's a factual account, but it's faction, if you like. It's written in a way that is, it's so exciting. And as I mean, I was there, so I went. I think
that's normally called narrative nonfiction. I think it's a true story, but it's written like a
But it's full of facts. But he's written it in such a way. It is so exciting. I just cannot put this book down. And my previous favourite book was another of his, Vulcan 607, because I was involved in the Vulcan raids during the Falklands War. So that really interested me. But this book is equally as good. I'm loving it. Absolutely loving it.
Brilliant.
So I wanted to give a plug. I wanted to give a plug for Harrier 809 because it's a brilliant book.
I know. Good. Plug away and mention it away. Yeah. And speaking of plug, you don't have to talk too much about your websites and everything. If anybody wants to check out Dougie's books, I'll have all the links in the comments or in the description or wherever you're watching or listening. It's all there. Dougie, thanks so much for doing this. It's been great.
My pleasure. It's been a game.
Thanks once more to Dougie for taking the time to talk to me and for giving me so much food for thought about the publishing world. Don't forget to check out Dougie's latest book, In the Know, which you can find links to on the on my website, on the YouTube channel description, and on the podcast show notes. Next week, I'll be talking to Jennifer Benson, a fellow teacher who listened to her inner voice, or as she calls it, her inner ding, and uprooted her whole life to move to the Middle East, which eventually led her to a beach on the morning of the 2004 tsunami in Thailand. It is a fascinating and powerful story. But that's for next week. For now, see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you loved listening to this episode just as much as I loved recording it. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Podchaser. Until then, be good, be brave, and tell stories. See ya.